The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Allende is successfully sworn in as the president of Chile in November of 1970, and for the next 3 years, basically, the Nixon administration shifts gears and works in a variety of areas, political, economic, and military, to destabilize and undermine Allende. And eventually, it seems to work. In 1973, September 11th, Allende is overthrown by Augusto Pinochet, who is the dictator for the next nearly 2 decades. And there's a longstanding debate about the kind of marginal influence that U.S. involvement had in the ultimate coup. But it's clear from the historical record that for 3 years, the administration was certainly trying from the shadows to overthrow Allende.
I'm David Preece, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, June 5th, 2020. We normally think of international law as constraining leaders' actions, especially aggression toward other countries. But what if one effect of an established international principle actually spurs more covert action against other countries? Michael Poznanski is an assistant professor of international affairs and intelligence studies in the Graduate School of Public and International Affairs, with a secondary appointment in the Political Science Department at the University of Pittsburgh. In his new book, In the Shadow of International Law, Secrecy and Regime Change in the Postwar World, Mike argues just this, that the principle of non-intervention that has come up in the past century has actually created powerful motives for leaders to engage in covert action more frequently to spur regime change. I recently sat down in the virtual jungle studio with Mike to talk through his thesis and its implications. It's the Lawfare Podcast, June 5th, Covert Action, Regime Change, and International Law, with Michael Poznanski. Mike, there are many angles to look at with covert action and international law, but you're not analyzing international law itself. You have a simple, elegant theory about why countries choose covert action over overt military action to change a regime, even when it's known that the chances of success for the covert action are low. Walk us through your thesis and the causal mechanisms behind it.
Sure. So that's exactly right. This is not a kind of deep in the weeds legal analysis of non-intervention, although there is some discussion of that legal debate. But primarily, it's a story about politics and how decision makers react to the international legal commitments they make and how this shapes intervention decisions in surprising ways. So let me pick up on something you just mentioned, which is that policymakers often choose covert action, even though they know it's less likely to succeed. And there are several reasons why covert action is less likely to succeed. So I just want to start there for a second. The first is that in order to achieve plausible deniability, big, powerful states like the US are still limited in the kinds of equipment and support they can provide to the actors that they're supporting to carry out particular policy. So if you're supporting locals to start an uprising or an insurgency, you can't provide them with state-of-the-art technology and arms because it would be clear to everybody that the United States or some other powerful patron had provided those resources. So that's a big limitation. And another limitation, which I've just alluded to, is that you're often working through local actors to accomplish your objective rather than doing it yourself. And again, this is all in the service of achieving plausible deniability. And those local actors, as many scholars have previously pointed out, may not share the same objectives that you do. They may exert different levels of effort than you deem optimal as the supporting state. And so all of these create interesting constraints. And yet, time and again, throughout the Cold War and beyond, policymakers reach for the covert or quiet option to accomplish certain objectives, in the case of the book, regime change. And the story I'm telling is that the primary cause of the rise of secrecy starting in the mid-20th century was the advent of these new rules governing intervention. And by rules, I mean, in the UN Charter and elsewhere, setting out the parameters of what states could legally and not legally do in terms of using force and interfering in the internal affairs of other states. And that had been kind of a norm since, you know, the advent of the Peace of Westphalia in 1648 and throughout the 17th, 18th, and 19th centuries, but it was never really codified in international law until the mid-20th century. And so the core argument I'm making is that that kind of change or shift in how states understood what was legitimate and not legitimate in terms of intervention explains the rise of secrecy.
So let's break that down a bit, because as you pointed out, the idea of non-intervention goes back at least 250 years, but it wasn't codified, and sovereigns didn't really follow through on it. They basically carved out exceptions for themselves up to the early 20th century, really. So what's the causal mechanism then by which, with the UN Charter explicitly, but also regional organizations putting into print a principle of non-intervention in other states, what's the causal mechanism by which that leads states to say, well, we're going to do it anyway, but we don't want to do it where it is so obvious that we're doing it?
Right. So this is a really important point. So, you know, in the 19th century, for example, this idea of a non-intervention norm was definitely floating around. But as you saw with the great European powers and the Concert of Europe, they routinely ignored this idea of non-intervention, a corollary of state sovereignty, and carved out exceptions for themselves. And the United States did this too in the early 20th century. You had things like the Platt Amendment, which was restrictive rules put on Cuba after the Spanish-American War that basically guaranteed the U.S. the right to intervene to protect life, liberty, and property and stability. Teddy Roosevelt extends this idea in the Roosevelt Corollary, which gives the U.S. broad police powers in the Western Hemisphere. But the United States, as it's building this post-war liberal international order after World War II, binds itself, along with a few other great powers, to these new rules of the road in the UN Charter. And they include things like a new prohibition on the use of force and a Security Council, which can authorize states, and the great powers have veto rights in this regard, but it can authorize states to intervene for the maintenance of peace and stability internationally. And as you also alluded to, the United States, along with Latin American countries, adopt similar provisions in regional bodies like the Organization of American States, and you see similar regional organizations in the Middle East and Africa adopting these non-intervention pledges. And what this does, I argue, is that it raises the costs for great powers who want to intervene to, say, overthrow a foreign regime. And those costs manifest in two ways. One, by committing to this non-intervention principle, the U.S. risks sullying its reputation for keeping its commitments and its credibility in terms of its treaty obligations. And secondly, it also risks undermining its moral authority, which was a big important part of the post-war liberal order. And so for all of these reasons, the U.S. is willing to subject itself to these constraints surrounding secrecy in order to avoid violating law openly.
Okay, so your argument is that the leaders actually do care about these things, so much so that they're willing to reduce the likelihood of success of U.S. government action.
That's right. I'm essentially making the claim that decision makers care so much about international law, they're willing to violate it secretly. And so that's kind of an interesting dynamic where it's not that they've necessarily internalized the parameters of international law or care about it per se. I'm agnostic about that. I'm sure some have and some haven't. But they care about the perception of violating international law so much so that they're willing to go covert.
Let's apply this to covert action in the modern sense, because conventional wisdom often holds that countries turn to covert action, not because of this dynamic, but because it's just cheaper than overt action. Why is that questionable?
Yeah, this is kind of a pet argument of mine that I like taking on, the idea that covert action is cheaper and therefore more attractive than overt alternatives. And the evidence people typically use in favor of this argument, which is very reasonable, is that if you compare a large-scale overt invasion, say the U.S. war in Iraq, to a more limited covert operation, whether in Cuba or Chile or Afghanistan, you name it, you do see stark differences in the amounts that these operations cost. But the claim I make in the book is that we actually shouldn't be thinking about covert action as cheaper per se. And the reason is many of the things you might do such that they were plausibly deniable, like arming insurgents or meddling in elections, you can either claim responsibility for them or not. So the physical act, meddling in elections and sponsoring insurgents, can be done openly or secretly at similar cost. And so we shouldn't actually be thinking about covert action as attractive because it's cheaper for that reason.
There are a few other explanations in general for decisions to go covert that you argue don't hold up as well as this importance of being seen as compliant with international law. So I wonder if you could quickly march through these. There's a domestic political explanation. There's an explanation about leaders wanting to avoid escalation with superpowers. And there's the explanation that nationalism and fears that overt action will trigger nationalism as a response holds countries back from overt action. Talk through each of those.
Sure. So let me begin with domestic politics, take them in the order. You kind of outlined them very succinctly. So the domestic politics story is the idea that leaders are attracted to plausibly deniable operations in cases where their kind of home audiences, the public, so to speak, would disapprove of whatever it is they were doing. And the explanation in this case for when leaders will pursue overt action is when they have public opinion on their side. The second explanation pertains to escalation. And this is the idea that I might pursue a plausibly deniable operation or covert action whenever I'm intervening in a state that is, say, allied with a powerful rival or would at least lead to some kind of escalation. And I'm attracted to overt action in cases when those escalation concerns are minimal. And the final explanation pertains to nationalism. And this is the idea that, you won't be surprised, local actors don't like foreign actors meddling around in their internal affairs, except under rare conditions when they'll kind of accept it, such as a shared perception of an external threat or the perceived need for kind of a short-term occupation or intervention. And what I do is, rather than say that any of these theories are deductively unsound, which I don't think they are, I just pit them against the historical record and test whether or not my international legal theory performs better across the cases I analyze. And I find time and again, escalation concerns in domestic politics in particular pointed in the opposite direction of what those theories would expect. And in the case of nationalism, concerns about inciting a nationalist backlash were observed in each of the two covert action cases that I analyze in the book, but policymakers were willing to kind of hold their nose and incur a nationalist backlash if they could legally justify intervention, which is consistent with the argument I'm making.
Yeah, so instead you argue that leaders will pursue regime change overtly only when they can locate a legal exemption from the non-intervention principle, but they'll turn to covert action otherwise. Basically, there's a difference between, and a significant meaningful difference between, brazen hypocrisy and hidden hypocrisy. Is that right?
Precisely. And I think this has been missed in a lot of the way people talk about the liberal order. And we can get to this later if you want. But the idea here is that it's true that since 1945, U.S. foreign policy has not always lived up to the ideals that policymakers have articulated. You could look at black sites, you could look at drone strikes or cooperation with certain allies like Saudi Arabia. But a key point I want readers to take away from the book is that we really ought to be distinguishing between cases in which policymakers tried, whether unsuccessfully or not, to conceal actions that violated the rules and norms they were propounding openly, and cases in which they were willing to dispense with them in public, whether or not because they had a justification to do so or some other reason.
Okay, let's talk about some of the cases that you looked at in depth using declassified archives, using memoirs, and some interviews with policymakers from the time. First, The U.S. covert action plans that eventually led to the notorious Bay of Pigs invasion in Cuba, Operation Zapata. Tell us about how that developed, both in the Eisenhower administration and then the Kennedy administration taking over the operation, and what you found that supports the idea that advisors in both administrations, and in some cases the presidents themselves, were that concerned about the perception of following international law.
This case I found really interesting, both for historical reasons and theoretical reasons. And a lot of people, when they think about the early 1960s, U.S., Cuba, and Soviet Union, they think about the Cuban Missile Crisis. But of course, the Bay of Pigs preceded that and in many ways facilitated Castro's close relationship with the Soviet Union. So what happened? In March of 1960, as the Eisenhower administration was concerned about Cuba aligning itself with the Soviet bloc, the proverbial 90 miles from America's shores, and of course, don't forget, the U.S. has Guantanamo Bay as a military base in the region, which they were also concerned about. So in March of 1960, Eisenhower authorizes a covert operation plan to overthrow Fidel Castro, who had come to power the year earlier in the Cuban Revolution. And this plan takes a lot of twists and turns over the course of 1960 and into 1961. It begins as this plan to infiltrate Cubans into the countryside and to incite an uprising and a kind of a guerrilla movement. Mm-hmm. And it evolves over the course of 1960 to become this kind of amphibious landing operation once policymakers believe that this infiltration plan or scheme is unlikely to work. And then, of course, we have elections. And Eisenhower is, of course, the end of his second term. John F. Kennedy is elected, and his team hands this plan off to Kennedy, who makes further tweaks in the beginning of 1961. He's particularly worried that the plan as it was currently conceived looked too much like what he called a World War II landing. So he makes decisions to make it even more plausibly deniable. So that's good. But this has the implication of making it less likely to succeed. And ultimately, it's this dramatic failure in mid-April 1961.
Am I right that they were both aware that it would be more successful if they were just to all out invade?
That's exactly right. And this is one of the key pieces of evidence I use to illustrate the power of the international law argument. Because if policymakers in the Eisenhower and Kennedy administration just chose covert action because they thought it was really likely to succeed, then it wouldn't be all that interesting that they opted for plausible deniability. What's much more interesting is that they stuck with secrecy knowing it had a lower chance of success.
Right. Well, it seems to me in what I know about these cases that there's some important historical precedent here, or at least some international activity that influenced the fact that Eisenhower was emphasizing in press conferences that non-interventionism was important in international affairs. And even in the Kennedy administration, we have to remember what was going on in the Warsaw Pact at the time and the fact that the Soviets were intervening within countries in their sphere, and the U.S. was trying to set themselves up to the world as not doing that. So I don't think it's that much of a surprise that they were looking for some excuse to intervene overtly. And I think, didn't you find evidence both for Eisenhower and for Kennedy that they considered fabricating an international incident to allow them to then take advantage of the international legal loophole to intervene openly?
Yeah, you've made a really important point, which I want to address first, and then I'll get to the fabrication, which is fascinating, mm-hmm. which is the idea that it's important when looking at these cases as a researcher to think about the broader context. And so policymakers were acutely aware of trying to distinguish themselves from what the Soviet Union was doing. As you said, in Hungary, the Soviet Union had cracked down in 1956, and policymakers were really worried about others drawing comparisons between what the U.S. might do in Cuba to what the Soviet Union had done in the Warsaw Pact. So that's a really important point. And it's certainly true that both in Eisenhower and Kennedy, the decision makers involved in the covert action plan thought about ways to legitimize an overt intervention. And that included both exogenous events that Castro might, for example, start killing Americans or attack Guantanamo Bay, in which case overt intervention would be legitimized. But more interestingly, they talk about ways to kind of induce Castro to do those kinds of things such that they could legitimize an overt intervention. One of the most interesting episodes here is Arthur Schlesinger, who's a dove and Kennedy's special assistant and a historian, talks in this memo he sends to Kennedy about possibly inducing or encouraging Castro to conduct a black operation in Haiti, or at least making it look like he did, as a way of giving the U.S. legal cover to intervene openly and therefore more successfully.
So as it turned out, we all know the Bay of Pigs invasion failed. It was exposed as a U.S. operation. There were calls against the United States for being hypocritical about intervening. But the very fact that, let's take just one part of it, that Kennedy held back on the very overt air support that was being called for, the fact that he held back from doing that preserved that fig leaf of following the formal rules of non-intervention?
This is a really puzzling aspect of the case, which is as soon as the operation commenced, everybody basically knew that the United States had sponsored these Cuban exiles, which of course is not inconsistent with what I'm trying to say in the book, which is the idea that I'm interested in why decision makers arrive at these decisions to pursue covert action, not necessarily whether they're successful. But it's certainly true that Kennedy, as the operation was unfolding, made key decisions that both undermined the chances of success, like providing air cover to the exiles, but also he hoped, and others believed later, still did give them that technical fig leaf of deniability that they so desperately wanted.
All right. Let's turn to another covert operation and attempt at regime change, which was against Salvador Allende in Chile. Different administration. Now we're talking about Richard Nixon instead of Eisenhower and Kennedy. But another case where the U.S. government decided not to openly try to overthrow a regime. What happened in this case, and how does it play out against your idea?
The United States and Chile have a long history together. And in the 1960s, the United States was consistently intervening covertly. This is both under the Kennedy and Johnson administrations, in support of what they viewed as kind of moderate center-left candidates, and at some points, center-right and rightist candidates. And by September of 1970, Salvador Allende, who had ran two times previously unsuccessfully for the presidency, looked poised to win. And so Nixon authorizes this covert action plan intended to overthrow him. And there are these kind of two tracks involved. Track one are nonviolent schemes, which include kind of encouraging a coup, whether by the outgoing president or someone else, and destabilizing the economy. And this track two involved direct coup plotting with the military. And the operation initially looks like it might have some legs, but it fails. Allende is successfully sworn in as the president of Chile in November of 1970. And for the next 3 years, basically, the Nixon administration shifts gears and works in a variety of areas, political, economic, and military, to destabilize and undermine Allende. And eventually, it seems to work. In 1973, September 11th, Allende is overthrown by Augusto Pinochet, who is the dictator for the next nearly 2 decades. And there's a longstanding debate about the kind of marginal influence that U.S. involvement had in the ultimate coup. But it's clear from the historical record that for 3 years, the administration was certainly trying from the shadows to overthrow Allende.
What I found fascinating in this case is that Henry Kissinger, the national security advisor and eventually Secretary of State for Nixon, who's often held up to be the hyper-realist put into a policy position, even he wrote that it would be very costly for us, the U.S. government, to act in ways that appear to violate those principles, referring to principles of non-intervention in international law.
I also found that extremely surprising. And this is a good way of thinking about the fact that policymakers need not internalize the importance of international law themselves in order to feel constrained by it. So, for example, I wouldn't necessarily claim, nor do I believe, that Kissinger would have prevented or would have felt inhibited from intervening from the standpoint of international law himself, but he was certainly worried about how this would reflect back on the United States.
Right. You balance these cases by looking at a couple of different outcomes where overt regime change, public intervention, was chosen instead of covert action. What happened in the Dominican Republic in 1965, and what was different there to support this idea about the fig leaf of international law mattering and looking for an excuse to intervene?
These cases were really important for the book because I need to not only show that international law and fears about violating it push decision makers into the covert sphere, but also that the availability of legal exemptions enables overt action. And so let's begin with this first case, the Dominican Republic. It's called Operation Power Pack. This is back when names of military operations were a little more fun and less anodyne. But anyway, it involves Lyndon Johnson deploying 21,000 troops roughly to the Dominican Republic in April 1965 to prevent what he called a second Cuba. And this is just as the Vietnam War is ramping up, so it's all the more surprising. And the claim here is that overt intervention was made possible in this case by the presence of two legal exemptions or pretexts or fig leaves. You can choose your synonym. Mm-hmm. The first was the claim that U.S. nationals were endangered by the early onset of a civil war between these constitutionalist forces who Johnson thought were communist and the outgoing military junta. And secondly, the administration was able to secure authorization for intervention from the Organization of American States, not immediately, but soon afterwards in the form of a multilateral peacekeeping force, which it could largely, although not entirely, steer the outcomes of. And both of these factors allowed Johnson to intervene openly with a reduced fear that this would undermine America's credibility or moral authority.
Sure. And in this case, Lyndon Johnson, of course, different leadership style than Richard Nixon, who had a different leadership style than John Kennedy and Eisenhower before him. But you were able to hold some of these other potential variables equal. It was in Latin America again. The Organization of American States was still covering some of the thought going behind these interventions. But the outcome is different, and it doesn't seem to be explained as well by the other alternatives.
That's right. So in all of these cases, the two covert action cases and the two overt action cases, all in a similar geographical region, the Western Hemisphere, all against weak states that at the time were not strongly aligned with the Soviet Union. And in a lot of these cases, including in Power Pack, escalation concerns or concerns about nationalism don't seem to perform as well as international law as an explanation for why Johnson ultimately opted for overt action.
Yeah. Let's look at your final case briefly. You looked at the Reagan administration's invasion of Grenada in October 1983. Same here, Mike, that variable or variables here were different than in the covert cases to prompt overt intervention. How so?
Yeah, you see a lot of parallels in this case with the Power Pack case. And this is Operation Urgent Fury, sticking with the theme of fun monikers for military operations. And this was precipitated by this coup in October of 1983 involving the New Jewel Movement, which was in charge of Grenada at the time, communist aligned, one leader, Morris Bishop, ousted by hardliners in the same regime. And in this case, as in Power Pack in the Dominican Republic, Reagan felt emboldened, I argue, to intervene openly for two reasons, because he had legal justifications surrounding the presence of medical students enrolled at St. George's Medical School on the island. And secondly, there was an invitation by an international body called the Organization of Eastern Caribbean States. And both of these factors, I argue, also enabled Reagan to intervene openly at reduced cost.
Mm-hmm. So in all of these cases, you make a good argument that credible self-defense claims or invitations from international organizations, I think in the Grenada case, what was it called? The Organization of East Caribbean States?
Or that's right.
Yeah. That they make open regime change more likely, while an absence of one or especially both of these pushes for covert action, even if success is much less likely.
Yeah, there are a number of ways to think about how to test that, but that's exactly right. One way I go about kind of making the case, as you've just outlined, is in both the Dominican Republic and the Grenada case, I try to show that prior to the existence of these two legal exemptions, policymakers were simultaneously interested in some form of regime change at various points and opted for covert action prior to the onset of endangered Americans or medical students or authorization from international bodies, all as a way of showing that it was the presence of these two conditions that are really doing a lot of the causal work here.
Right. Is there a possibility that it's lip service, not just publicly, but in fact, it's lip service even in NSC meetings, or in the Nixon case, the 40 committee meetings that you cite papers of, that They're just saying, almost with a wink and a nod to each other, oh yeah, we really care about international law. Did you get the sense from whether it's the nuance in the interviews or some archival research that, no, this really does seem to affect leaders, at least in the United States that you did research on?
I think if I were to only look at the overt cases, I would have a much harder time debunking or refuting the notion that this was just lip service. But there are a variety of reasons why I think it's actually quite credible. One is that if you're looking at declassified records, policymakers, by and large, feel a little freer to speak plainly about what's motivating them to do something than if they think they're making a public speech or particular documents will be publicized later. So that increased my confidence slightly. But more significantly, in each of the covert action cases, which I compared to these overt interventions, I found that policymakers, as we've already discussed, tried really hard to find legal exemptions that would have justified overt interventions that they believed would be more effective. So I think it's the combination of the type of evidence, declassified documents where there were fewer incentives to lie, and also this cross-case comparison where you look at instances of secrecy and show that policymakers were worried about many of the same things and tried to find the very same pretexts they were able to locate in the DR and Grenada.
Yeah. Let's talk about the challenge of a more recent intervention, and that is the Bush 43 intervention in Iraq in 2003. In that case, it appears, and tell us, maybe they were looking for international legal justification, but the invasion took place without the same level of either the Grenada case or the Dominican Republic case. What in there is still a silver lining for your idea about the importance of looking like you're adhering to international law?
The Iraq 2003 case is really important for all of the reasons you mentioned. So I tackle it in the concluding chapter of the book, and I place the U.S.-Iraq relationship in this broader context, really starting in 1991. And what you see there, this is Desert Storm, of course, is that there's ample evidence that the Bush administration, 41, didn't march all the way to Baghdad, in part because of the legal constraints, and it would have exceeded the mandate of the UN Security Council.
So right, really, and Bush and Scowcroft are very, very clear about that at the time.
Precisely. They make these public statements. It signals U.S. Restraint. So that's great. But we know from at least limited reporting from the 90s that months after Desert Storm concludes, Bush authorizes a covert action plan to destabilize and hopefully overthrow Saddam. Clinton picks some of this up. And I don't want to go too much into detail, in part because there aren't many and details are sparse, and we'll probably have to wait many years before the records are declassified. But what I infer from that episode is if you compare Bush's indication that he doesn't want to exceed the mandate as a restraint in Desert Storm with the fact that he went covert, that international law might have been doing some work there. So let's talk about 2003. On its face, this seems to present some challenges for the argument I'm making. And of course, no theory will predict every case. So that's not worrisome per se, but it is important to address. And essentially, the argument I make is that the Bush administration, although they ultimately intervene without Security Council authorization or a viable self-defense claim, they do try really hard on both of these fronts. So with regard to self-defense, this infamous 2002 national security strategy, which tries to redefine preemption or prevention as not just an imminent attack, but one that is sometime down in the future as justifying a self-defense claim. And Colin Powell and others go to the UN to try to get Security Council authorization. Of course, they fail and ultimately intervene anyway. But the fact that they took months and put in lots of effort to try to get these legal justifications, I suggest, is consistent, even though the ultimate outcome is not necessarily what I would have predicted.
Sure. And also the fact that they pointed out repeatedly, Iraq was in violation of several UN sanctions that had been put on it before. So again, putting on the veneer of international law as an excuse for the intervention.
That's right. And they pointed to these unanimous or at least large majority vote UN resolutions that Iraq and Saddam Hussein in particular was in violation of all of these credible promises surrounding WMD. So it is a really complicated story, actually.
Yeah, and also for your argument, it might be interesting to note that there was another intervening variable, which is right before that was 9/11. And Dick Cheney in, I think, November of 2001 had had said something that came to be interpreted as the 1% doctrine, that if there was a 1% chance that a threat was real, that the U.S. government had to treat it as a certainty in terms of a response. In that post-9/11 environment, going to the United Nations Security Council to try to get legal justification, even after articulating such a strong interventionist doctrine, doesn't necessarily harm the idea that they cared about how it looked internationally.
I think that's right. And it's also worth noting that after the Iraq War was on for some years, the Bush administration walked back some of its early unilateralism from the first term. And of course, Obama continues that trend and tries to engage more multilaterally. So this kind of twilight period right after 9/11 is probably doing a lot of work here, too.
I'll ask you to ad lib a bit here, but have you seen anything in this administration's handling of Iran, whether it's Iranian activity in Iraq against U.S. personnel or U.S. interests, whether it's Iranian activity in the Gulf itself? Have you seen anything here that makes you think twice about your argument, or does it largely the lack of major intervention against Iran other than the Soleimani killing? Does this basically back up the ideas you're expressing here?
Yeah, it's a little difficult to say the scope of U.S. covert operations either against Iran or otherwise for obvious reasons, but the Trump administration's foreign ventures, so I'm going to broaden it a little bit to kind of contextualize, but it's a little difficult to know what to make of it. So if you recall back when the Trump administration authorized a military strike against Bashar al-Assad in Syria for the chemical weapons use, this was clearly not authorized by the Security Council, but it was upholding this norm against the use of chemical weapons generally and particularly against civilians. So, and in the Qasem Soleimani strike, which you alluded to, the Trump administration didn't say this is in the U.S. national interest only. They pointed to the fact, whether or not this is dubious is a really important question, but they still pointed to the fact that the strike was authorized to kind of preempt an imminent attack from Soleimani and the Quds Force. So there are indications that the Trump administration is at least paying some lip service to international law and norms. Whether or not that would constrain the Trump administration from intervening more seriously and openly in Iran or North Korea, I think is an open question. Mm-hmm. But so far, it's been an interesting dynamic where they are at least invoking these kind of tried and true American ideals.
And we remain in a situation now, it's been for a couple of administrations now, where we have the U.S. military openly using drones in theaters of war. And then you've got some theaters of war in which there is drone use, but it is not officially acknowledged by the U.S. government. Does your argument help explain this different acknowledgement of drone use in different areas?
I'm glad you brought this up. So this is actually part of the subject of the second book project I'm working on in the very early stages, which is thinking about secrecy a little more recently and in different domains. And in the case of drones, I could tell a story without a lot of evidence because it's difficult to come by that seems consistent with the international legal argument. It would go something like this. In theaters or countries where the U.S. Has this kind of legal right to be operating militarily in this post 9/11 environment, you're more likely to see acknowledged counterterrorism drone strikes. And in places where the U.S. is not supposed to be legally operating, or at least it's less clear, like Yemen and maybe elsewhere, you're more likely to see these plausibly deniable operations. But I do think there are also other dynamics at play that may have very little to do with international law. So, for example, in the case of Pakistan, the U.S. operating a drone program in the federally administered tribal areas, there's this interesting dynamic where the president of Pakistan, Musharraf, met some years ago, was tolerating U.S. operating in those regions, but would claim credit for them. And the U.S. accepted this because otherwise it would have looked like the Pakistanis were rolling over to the United States and caving to U.S. demands to violate their own sovereignty. So I think the relationship between the host nation and the U.S. might be doing a lot of work in the drone space as well.
Sure. You focus in your work so far on the United States, but what are your thoughts on whether this logic holds for countries other than the United States?
I think there are good reasons to believe it applies, but not universally so. And what I mean by that is, in order for international law to serve as a meaningful constraint on states, they actually have to care about the costs associated with violating it. So, for example, I don't have a lot of confidence that North Korea would care too much about violating international law, at least in terms of its credibility and moral authority. But I do think it applies to states that do give consideration to these kinds of costs. So one example would be Great Britain. And there's this really excellent history of British covert action by Rory Cormack, came out a couple of years ago. And he finds that lots of British covert ops in Yemen and Indonesia, for example, in the 1950s, were secret in large part because of their concerns about commitments to the United Nations. And more surprisingly, perhaps, I also think the logic applies, maybe imperfectly so, to the Soviet Union during the Cold War. And so you might be thinking, how does an autocratic superpower that was a dictatorship at home and in its informal empire apply, or why would they care about international law? And I found in the course of my research for this book that there were instances in which they referenced their own commitments to the United Nations, because remember, the Soviet Union cared, at least publicly, about its image for promoting self-determination and anti-colonialism. Right. Mm-hmm. And so I found that right before the Soviet Union invaded Afghanistan in 1979, on Christmas Day, part of what held them back from doing that even earlier was this concern about being painted as a foreign aggressor. Now, ultimately, they do intervene and stay there for the next nearly 10 years, but it did serve to shape how they pursued that conflict.
Sure. Let's close with a wild card here. If not a wild card, at least a different factor. It would seem that the progress of international law and norms would over time lead to a situation with less covert action as people adhered more and more to principles of non-intervention, even in the covert area. But you raise that the development of one doctrine could actually go the other direction, and that is the development of the doctrine of responsibility to protect. In one sense, you can see that increasing the excuses for overt intervention, as countries wouldn't need to be covert anymore to protect. But depending on how that's interpreted, if it doesn't quite meet the bar for being overt, you could see countries almost saying, well, we feel okay intervening more because we've been intervening more overtly. Maybe we'll look for more excuses on the margins. How do you think responsibility to protect really would play out in terms of intervention, both in terms of raw numbers, but also the breakout between overt and covert interventions?
Yeah, I think at the moment, responsibility to protect, which is kind of developed in the early 2000s as a response to the international community's failure to intervene in places like Rwanda, at the moment, R2P still requires Security Council authorization. So I've spoken with some folks who are involved in the R2P space, and they're not too worried about R2P being used as a fig leaf to justify geopolitically driven interventions under the guise of humanitarianism. And the reason, again, is it requires the five members of the Security Council to sign off on it. So to that extent, if that's true, it's unlikely to provide a lot of latitude for states wanting to pursue self-interested interventions under the guise of humanitarianism. But if it's perceived that the Security Council is hopelessly deadlocked and R2P becomes a pretty widely accepted standard for intervening, I would certainly expect that you'd see an uptick in interventions. And this doesn't mean because states suddenly found it in their hearts to be good humanitarians, there may be some of that, but because they have an excuse now to intervene under broader auspices than just self-defense or Security Council authorization. And in this regard, it's worth noting that the Libya intervention in 2011 was justified partly on the basis of R2P, it got Security Council authorization. And Russia and other countries' reaction to what they perceived as overreach by the Obama administration to go after, or at least enable the rebels to go after Gaddafi directly, I think is likely to kind of limit the scope and scale of R2P as a widely accepted norm moving forward.
Mike Posnansky, thank you for joining us.
David, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Don't forget to share this podcast, rate this podcast, tweet about this podcast, send a Facebook post about this podcast. You don't have to do all of that, but we do appreciate you doing at least some of it. I'll also let you know that we have new merchandise coming soon to the Lawfare store. which you can access from our website. And also, if you are able, we would appreciate your support for our nonprofit endeavors here at Lawfare at lawfareblog.com/support-lawfare. This episode was edited and produced by Jen Pacha Howell. Ian Enright of DC's Goat Rodeo Studios was our audio engineer, and Sophia Yan performed our music. As always, thanks for listening.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.